Well, Easter Sunday is a great day, and churches all over the world are filled on Easter. And it just seems like we as a culture, we love Easter. And we love it for lots of reasons. Like, how many of you are wearing something new today? Come on, fess up, new shirts, socks, underwear. New Easter underwear. It's a hot seller. You should try it. Check it out. Well, I think there's lots of reasons that we love Easter. We love Easter because in the spring, it's kind of when winter is becoming spring. You know, the trees are blossoming, and that's all fun to see the changes of the season. You guys probably have flowers like tulips that are just starting to push up through the ground. You probably have some trees that are just blossoming or maybe budding out, maybe some of your bushes out front. It's just a reminder that finally winter is over. Which is like the best part about Easter, maybe, for some people. Winter is over. I asked my neighbor yesterday, I said, do you think it's going to snow anymore? And he's like, I hope not. And in Nebraska, we're never quite sure, right? We could get another snow. Well, we love Easter. And, you know, for farmers in farming places like this, Easter is always that time when either, you know, depending on when Easter falls, it's either just about to get into the field, so they're like, because that's what farmers get, you know, can't wait to get in the field. Or they've already been outgoing. It represents this time of work and raising crops. If you're a teacher, spring break and Easter kind of go together. So when you get to Easter, you can almost see the end of the year. It's coming. You know it's coming. There's a lot of things to love. Well, Easter, you may be interested to know, is the most attended Sunday of the entire year. It's about 25 to 30% higher in attendance than any other Sunday. And what's funny about that is usually around Easter, you know, Good Friday, maybe the Monday after, there's usually a holiday, so a lot of people leave, but it always seems like more people come. And I'm not sure where everybody comes from, but there's always, at least from my perspective, it looks like more people are coming. Well, regardless, there are many people that Easter is just one of those Sundays you go to church. It's just what you do. You go to church. And maybe it's because you're visiting in town and mom wants you to go to church. Or maybe it's a tradition you have and so you go to church. It's just kind of what you do. Maybe you grew up in a church that it was always, you know, Easter was a big deal and you kind of want to do the same with your kids. And so this is a Sunday you come to church. But whatever the case, there are some people that will be in church today for reasons that are different than the reasons on most Sundays they don't go to church. Let me say that again. There are people that will be in church today for reasons that are different than the reasons they typically give for why they don't go to church on most Sundays. And I understand why. I was talking to a guy recently, inviting him to church, inviting him to Easter Sunday, and he said, I only go to church one time a year, and I go to church on Easter. So every year I decide what church I'm going to go to, and that's the church I go to. I said, okay. And he said, but my big beef with going to church on Easter Sunday, and my big beef with church in general, is that every time I go, they're always talking about the same thing. You get that? He goes once a year on Easter and then complains they're always talking about the same thing every time they go. And so I said, you know, if you go to church on other Sundays, there are other things we talk about. Dead serious. He goes, really? You know, so if you go to church on Christmas and Easter, you're like, they only talk about the birth and the death. That's all we got. Well, there's lots of other things that we talk about throughout the year. So maybe you think you know those stories pretty well, and so since you know the stories pretty well, why go to church every Sunday? And I get what you're saying. You don't want to give up what you do on Sunday mornings. And I get that. Sunday mornings maybe for you is one of the days or maybe the only day you get to sleep in a little bit. Or maybe for you it's the day you get some coffee and you get your newspaper and you sit in the sun a little bit and you just kind of enjoy the morning. Or maybe it's a morning that you and your wife or you and your husband or you and your girlfriend, that you go out for coffee together and it's the only day that you can do that. Well, regardless, what you are doing in that moment and with that those thoughts is that you're doing a time cost evaluation. And when you do a time cost evaluation, you don't think it is worth giving up these things in order to gain these things. You don't think giving up these things is worth it to gain these things. And so what I want to do today is I want to show you a bunch of guys in the Bible that when they looked at that cost question, that cost evaluation question, they thought that they were paying one thing only to find out later they had seriously miscalculated the cost. And I want to show you that story. If you have your Bibles and you want to go to John chapter 11 in the Pew Bible, it's on page 898. John chapter 11. And I want to read a little bit of this story and just kind of walk through what is going on. But again, what's going to be behind the story is the question of cost. Cost and the calculation of cost. Because everything has a cost. Following Jesus has a cost. But let me ask you, are you counting the cost correctly? So let's read the story. John chapter 11, verse 45 says, "Many of the Jews, therefore, who had come with Mary and had seen what he did, believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done." So let's pause right there and just make sure we understand what's going on in the story. When it says that Jesus did something, what he did, the "did" refers to what we find in the previous section. Now, in your Bible, you can look at your previous section and find the story of the raising of Lazarus from the dead. Now, if you grew up in the church, you know the story of Lazarus and what Jesus did with Lazarus. Well, that story says, and here's the skinny of the story, Jesus has a really good friend, maybe his best friend in the world. He dies. He's in the grave 4 days. Jesus comes along, and he rises again. And Jesus resurrects him. That's the story. But after Jesus got done doing that, that's the short part of the story, there were some that saw what happened, and evidently they reported back to the Pharisees this story, what Jesus has done, the miracle, the wonder. And, you know, this is one of those miracles that nobody could say, nah, he didn't do that. Because Lazarus was there. He was alive. He was walking around the marketplace. You could see him on the road. He was your neighbor. You knew him for years, whatever. You couldn't say that Lazarus wasn't alive because you could just go down to 124 Main Street, knock on the door, and there was Lazarus. So the story, the miracle of the raising of Lazarus, took the fame of Jesus to a whole new level. And really, at this level, this is when we begin to hear that the authorities are starting to look for a way to get rid of Jesus. But it's because of his fame. It's because the masses were following him. Let's keep reading of the story, verse 47. "So the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered the council and said, 'What are we to do? For this man performs many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation.'" Now, this is actually a very crazy verse. And we don't understand how crazy it is because we're not a bunch of Jews living in the first century. Because when a Jew, if he had read this, he would have said, there's no way that could have happened. So let me explain why this is crazy. This verse talks about three different groups of people. The first it calls the chief priests. Well, the chief priests were ex-high priests. So once you performed the function of high priest, you became a part of this group called the chief priests. The second group is called the Pharisees. They were like the rich, ruling, religious class. They had a lot of the money, they had a lot of the respect, they held a lot of the positions, the primary positions. They were the Pharisees. But then the third group is this group simply called the council, or maybe your Bible says the Sanhedrin. They would be kind of like the Supreme Court. They would make judgments on people that would break the law or certain things related to the law. So you have three groups of people, the chief priests, the Pharisees, and the council, or the Sanhedrin. These three never agreed on anything. In fact, they couldn't stand each other. It would be like the Democrats, the Republicans, and the Border Patrol coming together and talking about the wall. Can you imagine being in a meeting like that? They're not going to agree on anything, right? So this group, they never agreed on anything. They never got along. They never talked. They didn't like each other. They didn't spend time with each other. They didn't hang out. They didn't have over for supper. Nothing. So for them to come together and identify the threat, just that part right there is amazing. That threat must have been so much more than just a small growing threat. It must have been a huge threat to them. And they said, we got to do something. We can't let this keep going on. We've got to do something or we're going to lose everything. And to understand what they meant by we're going to lose everything, you got to get yourself back in their shoes a little bit. The ruling religious class, made up of these kind of three separate chambers, we can maybe call them, the religious ruler, this class of people, they held all of the power and most of the wealth in Israel. And the wealth part especially came because from all over the world, Jews would send money to Israel. It was called a temple tax. It wasn't just for the people that lived in Israel. It was from any Jew living anywhere. They would have to send the money for the temple tax. And so all year, every year, money flowed into the temple. And it was this group, the chief priests, the Pharisees, and the Sanhedrin, the council, they're the ones that decided where the wealth went. And guess where the wealth went? That's where a lot of it went. Now, they got to decide where to spend the money, and they make sure the priests had what they needed, and the temple, and decorations, and any repairs, and those kinds of things. But the primary source of their wealth came from the temple tax. And so they were the ones that decided where this money went. And so in your mind, you got to realize money is flowing in. They're the ones now for several generations who have been deciding, hey, this is where the money is going to go. And so when they say, we're going to lose everything, they're talking about losing their power, they're losing their position, they're losing their future, they're losing their income. Think salary, think security. We're going to lose everything. And what's funny is that they never agreed on anything except to keep the money. That's one thing they did agree on. But you got to feel in this verse that the pressure must have been so great that it took that amount of pressure is what it took to get these three groups that never did anything together, that couldn't stand each other, for them to come together and agree. The pressure must have been tremendous. And as they looked at the pressure and as they felt that, they realized that this was a cost that they were unwilling to pay. To just let Jesus keep on going, just to let him do his thing, let his fame grow, potentially to lose everything. It was a cost that they were unwilling to pay. And that cost question, I would argue, is what keeps a lot of people from following Jesus still today. They look at the cost and they say, I'm not willing to pay it. I am not willing to pay that. I don't want to give up my friends. I don't want to give up my lifestyle. I don't want to give up this relationship. I don't want to give up all these things. I don't want to pay the cost. I don't want to pay the price to follow Jesus. The price, the cost, is just too high. It's the same problem that these religious rulers had. They were deathly afraid of what they might lose, and they just couldn't sit back and do nothing. Let's keep going with the story. Verse 49 and verse 50, we're introduced to kind of a, think of like president or CEO, called the high priest. Verse 49, we're introduced to this guy. But one of them, Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year, said to them, you know nothing at all, nor do you understand that it is better for you that one man should die for the people, not that the whole nation should perish. Now, this is a real jaw dropper. And again, because we're not good Jews, because we're not well-versed in the law, we don't understand what is going on here and why this is crazy. Let me try to explain it. So you have these three groups, kind of these three chambers, right? You have the chief priests, you have the Pharisees, and you have the Supreme Court, the Sanhedrin. They never agreed on anything. But one thing they did agree on was that the Old Testament law was central to everything in Israel. That the Old Testament law was the most important thing. In fact, the big beef they had with Jesus is that he said things like, I'm going to come and destroy the temple. He said things like, I'm going to touch this leper, this unclean person. He would do things like heal, meaning work, on the Sabbath. So part of the big beef they had with Jesus was that he didn't follow the letter of the law. These guys, these three chambers, their job was to keep the letter of the law and to make sure that everybody in Israel, every one of those Jews, they were all keeping the law. That was their primary responsibility, to oversee the law. They were like the keepers of the law. Maybe you can think of it that way. That was their job. That's what they had to do. That was their job description. Now, of that Old Testament law, there's all kinds of rules about all kinds of different things, but there's 10 that we call the Ten Commandments that sit at the heart of the Old Testament law. One of those commandments says, thou shalt not murder. And thou shalt not murder sits at like part of the foundation for the entire rest of the Old Testament law. Here's why this is a jaw dropper. These three groups, chief priests, Pharisees, Sanhedrin, coming together and have a discussion on how to break the law. Do you get that with me? How are we together as the caretakers of the law going to break the law? How is this going to happen? That's why when a Jew would read this, they'd be like, what? You don't break the law. This would be like, you know, if you hear about a policeman that breaks the law, you feel like a policeman is supposed to keep the law. They're entrusted with being peacemakers and peacekeepers and to keep the law. They get to speed whenever they want. That's a perk. But everything else, they're supposed to keep the law, right? These guys don't break the law. They were stingy on every letter, every dot, every period, everything along the law. They come together to decide, how are we going to break the law? Now, that's amazing. In fact, how bad was it in this meeting? John 11:53 says, so from that day on, they made plans to kill him. They made plans to break the law. They made plans to put Jesus to death. So you got to feel how high the pressure must have been on them. You got to feel how tremendous this change would have been for them, that they were willing to break the law and to risk all that breaking the law would have meant for them in order to stop Jesus. And just to tell you how bad it was, as they got together in this plotting to try to kill Jesus, he wasn't the only one they decided they needed to kill. Because in the next chapter we read, when the large crowd of the Jews learned that Jesus was there, they came not only on account of him, but also to see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. So the chief priests made plans to put Lazarus to death as well. So this meeting to decide, what are we going to do with the Jesus problem, concluded with, we got to snuff out Jesus, and we got to kill Lazarus. That's the way we stop the problem. Now, why Lazarus? Well, just like it says here, it's because of this great miracle. Nobody could dispute it. But if they could kill Lazarus, they would take this like walking around tangible proof that Jesus is who he said, and they could, pardon the pun, bury the evidence. They could stop it all. They could put their foot on the brake if they could get rid of Lazarus. So we got to kill Jesus, kill Lazarus. And if we do those two things, then we stop it all. Read in the back of your mind, we get our power back. We secure our wealth. We secure our future. We get everything back that we feel like we are losing. And that's how counting the cost works. We do everything possible to protect ourselves from losing what we hold dear. It's like an addiction. Let's say somebody you know is an alcoholic. They know it's killing them. You know it's killing them. But they just can't let it go. They can't walk away. It has its grip. Its talons are in their lives. Let me tell you a story. Young man I knew in Minnesota came to our youth group on occasion. I was good friends with his uncle. Great athlete. Great kid. Very difficult home life. Mom and dad were alcoholics. The extended family, what they did when they got together, they drank. Like literally into oblivion. So this kid grew up in this really rough home. But he was a great athlete, gets into high school. He really could have gone a long ways into college, but he couldn't stay away from the bottle, so he kept getting kicked off teams. So then he wanted to go to college, but no college would take a gamble on this kid who kept getting kicked off the team. So he decides he's going to go into the army so he can clean up. And for a while he does, but he can't stay away. So he's discharged and he goes back to his home. And within a year, kills himself driving drunk. And you look at a story like that and you're like, and you think, how can he get there? Why didn't he just say no? Why didn't he just walk away? Well, here's the second part of the story. Guess what his family did to honor and commemorate his death? They all went out and got drunk. That's what addiction does. You just can't walk away. It doesn't matter if it's hurting you. It doesn't matter if it's killing your life. You can't walk away. And it's not just people who, it's easy to kind of look at the alcoholic and say, yeah, I see it there. But it's what we all do. With these things that we refuse to get rid of, these things that we hold so dearly. And we can hold them so tightly, it doesn't matter if it's hurting us, it doesn't matter if it's killing us, it's dear to us, and we won't let it go. And because we won't let it go, we think that there is no cost that we would be willing to pay to let it go. And I think that's why so many people resist following Jesus. There is a cost. There is a cost of following Jesus. But I would argue that the cost of not following him is far greater. I think what happens for a lot of people is they're so afraid of what they might lose that they never consider what they might gain. And cost is always that way. And it doesn't matter if it's an addiction to alcohol or some other kind of dearly held thing. We think, how am I going to get rid of this thing that is so dear, and what is going to replace it, and will it be any better? And that's where these rulers were. They looked at the story of Jesus, they looked at with the fame, and they looked at this great miracle of Lazarus, and his fame is growing, and they said, we just can't stomach the cost. We're not willing to pay it. And they grew desperate. How desperate? John 12:19 simply says, the Pharisees said to one another, look, the whole world has gone after him. Everyone. They're all going after him. In other words, they're not following us, they're following him. And if we don't stop it, we're going to lose everything. He's going to have the crowds, he's going to have the fame, he's going to have all the power, and we're not going to have anything. The whole world is going after him, and we're not about to take the leftovers. The whole world. Well, you say, well, you know, what does it mean, the whole world? Well, let me try to tell you a little bit about what they mean by the whole world. If you know the story, if you grew up in church, you know the story of the feeding of the 5,000. 5,000, that's a lot of people. But it's 5,000 men plus women and children. It's more like 12,000. That's about half of Hastings that go and follow. Now, that's a big crowd. And in all four of the Gospels, we read about these great crowds. Here's just a couple samples. Matthew 4, great crowds followed him from Galilee and the Decapolis. Mark 5, and he went off with him, and a large crowd was following him and pressing in on him. Luke 14, now large crowds were going along with them, and he turned and said to them. John 6, a large crowd followed him because they saw the signs which he was performing on those who were sick. A large crowd, big crowd, throngs, masses, maybe we call them mobs of people. They're all following Jesus. And if they're following Jesus, they are not following the Pharisees. They are not following the chief priests. They are not following the Sanhedrin. They are following Jesus. And just to ratchet it up to the next level, it wasn't just the crowds. Some of the people, the people inside, the insiders in these three chambers, some of them were leaving to follow Jesus too. Acts 15:5, some believers in Jesus, who followed to the party of the Pharisees, rose up and said, so these are insiders. The very people that were worried about losing everything were some of the same people that said, I think it's true. I think he is the Messiah. I'm going to follow him. I'm going to go. And they left the crowd. They left the group to follow Jesus. If you remember who buried Jesus, a guy named Joseph of Arimathea, he only gets a little tiny footnote in the Bible. He was one of these people. He was part of the Sanhedrin. He left and he followed Jesus. So yeah, did it seem like the whole world was following? Yeah. Did it seem like the whole world was going? Yeah. Did it seem like they were losing everything? Yeah. Were they afraid? Yes. They were willing to do whatever it took to protect themselves. So if you think about their plan a little bit, their plan was to kill Jesus, kill Lazarus. Because if we kill Jesus, if we kill Lazarus, we can stop the whole thing. Now, we don't know anything else about the story of Lazarus. There's a great tradition that he became the bishop, I think, of Crete later on in life. We don't know. But we do know that they killed Jesus. Their plan to stop the fame of Jesus by killing him was not a very good plan. Roughly on the planet right now, there's about 2 billion people that think Jesus is something special. Over the course of the last 2,000 years, how many people have followed Jesus? We don't know, but it's in the billions. So their best hatch plan didn't work out too well for them at all. Well, maybe you think, well, you know, if Jesus was really the Son of God and Jesus really had all this power, well, how could all of that happen to him? What's the deal with that? Who really had the power? Well, what's interesting about that question is that Jesus, one chapter before this meeting, this plotting to kill him, he actually addresses that very question. Here's what he says in John 10. He says, "For this reason," this is a great passage, "for this reason the Father loves me, because I lay down my life that I may take it up again." Look at this. Look at these next six words. "No one takes it from me." Now, again, this is before the meeting to say, let's kill Jesus. He addresses it by saying, "No one takes it from me." Nobody, not a bunch of religious rulers or anybody else. "I lay it down of my own accord." I have the authority to lay it down, and I have the authority to take it up. So the question of, well, you know, did Jesus know this was coming? Did Jesus know they were going to come and do this? Was this a big surprise? I turned on Killing Jesus last night for a few minutes. And it just happened to be the section where Judas betrays Jesus. And I don't like how they presented it because it looked like Jesus was like caught off guard. Like he didn't know they were coming. Like it was all a surprise to him. And Jesus knew it was coming, not only because of texts like this, but also because the Garden of Gethsemane sits right on the other side of Jerusalem. So if the guards and the mob of people come out of Jerusalem, there's a snake trail that he would be able to see from his vantage point all the way up. So he knew they were coming. He wasn't surprised by it at all. Even when he went, the Palm Sunday is this big celebration of Jesus coming into Jerusalem. You think he didn't know what was coming in 5 days? He knew it all. He knew where all of this was heading, and it changed nothing about what he did. What I love about this verse, here's the last section, he says, and it's a hint of something glorious. He says, "I have the authority to lay it down, and I have the authority to take it," meaning my life, "up again." In John chapter 10, he knew he was going to die. But he also knew that death wouldn't be the end for him. That he had the authority to take up that life again, to rise again, to be resurrected. He knew that death wasn't going to be the end. And he says, "I have the authority," nobody else, not a bunch of rulers, not these three chambers, not anybody else who thinks they have power, not the Romans. "I have the authority. I lay it down when I want, and I'm going to take it back up again." What is ironic, I think, in the whole story is that just 40 years after the resurrection of Jesus from the dead, what happens in AD 70 is that the Romans come into Jerusalem and they completely decimate the temple, they decimate Jerusalem, and they functionally end the practice of Judaism still to this day. So you have the chief priests, you have the Pharisees, you have the Sanhedrin that are worried they're going to lose everything. And their plan to make sure they weren't going to lose everything was to kill Jesus. Little did they know that some of them would live to see the day where they would lose everything. They thought it was going to be through Jesus. In the end, it was not. So these rulers, they miscalculated the cost. And people have been miscalculating the cost ever since. There are so many things in our life that just seem so much more important than following Jesus. And what happens is that we all become slaves to those things. But I want to wonder just for a minute with you if Easter is your one Sunday of the year that you come to church. I just want to wonder out loud with you a little bit if you have calculated the cost correctly. Where you view following Jesus only in the sense of all the things that you will lose, that you think you're going to lose, instead of counting the cost from all the things that you're going to gain in following Jesus. And I don't want you to be like these Pharisees who think that the only way that they're going to stop all of this, the only way they're going to protect themselves, the only way they're going to win in the end is by getting rid of Jesus. Only to have the whole thing by the end of their life, the whole thing was all miscalculated. Can you imagine getting to the end of your life? Only to realize that all the things that you thought were so near and dear to your heart were the very things that didn't matter ultimately. There are going to be a lot of people that end that way. And I've sat with people at the end of their life. Nobody says, I wish I had worked more. I wish I had built more. At the end of their life, they're talking about things that matter for eternity. I'm worried about my kids. I'm worried about their future. I'm worried about who's following Jesus. I can't wait for the next step. That's what people talk about at the end of their life because those are the things that matter forever. So again, are you sure you're counting the cost correctly? Are you sure you're not miscalculating what is of highest value and miscalculating what is of lowest value? So I ask you to consider that perhaps the reason that you resist following Jesus is because you fear what you are going to lose. And saying yes to Jesus will cost you something, but saying no will cost you far more. Are you counting the cost correctly? Are you sure you got the right numbers? Are you sure your values are not short-term but long-term? It's a question of cost. And I don't want you guys or any of us to miscalculate in such a way that in the end, it costs us eternity. Don't miscalculate the cost.